day, ladies and gents. This is Red Ice Radio. Our website is redicecreations.com. My name is Henrik, and as always, it's very good to have you with us, either if you're a regular listener or a newcomer to the program. And today we have Jim Elwidge back with us on the program. We first had Jim with us in March of last year, and he is, of course, the author of The Universe Solved. And we have quite a few things on the plate here today that we're going to focus on. Primarily the singularity, infomania, and programmed reality. The technological singularity is something that we've talked on and off about on this program. And Jim wrote to me with some really interesting points from an article he recently written that is basically suggesting that the singularity might not happen anytime soon, or maybe not at all. We'll discuss why this might be the case here today. There's also some recent news that seemed to suggest the idea of a programmed reality, like the recent GEO-600 gravitational wave detector in Germany that have been having some issues. And also we're going to get into this idea more about the infomania, the basic flood of the information, how kind of the systems and the computers and everything is kind of clogging up in a way with information, and least of all our brains, much in the same way. There's just too many interruptions during the workday with emails, with text messages and what have you. So this is some of the things that we'll dive into here today. The website, of course, that you can follow along in during the program, or definitely spend some time on later on, is theuniversesolved.com, and there you can read more about the book. There's articles, a blog up there that follow along in many of the news stories that come out that kind of support the idea of a program reality. So much information up there for you to check out, theuniversesolved.com. Okay, Jim, welcome back to the program. Very nice to have you with us again.
Thank you very much, Henrik, and I'm very pleased to be back on the program.
It's going to be really interesting. There's so many fascinating ideas here that we want to discuss here today. But basically, maybe we can just do a quick run-through of the theory about a program reality. I think that will give us a good background as we move into some of these other areas here. So, if you will, what is some of the evidence that we are, or might be, rather, living in a program reality, Jim?
Sure. I'd be glad to run through that quickly. Basically, the idea is that in a program reality idea, everything that you perceive is under program control or is generated by some computational mechanism. And people often think of the movie The Matrix or things like that, where a simulation is sort of injected into your mental process. And in that movie, it was injected to your brain. But it wasn't. It's not necessarily the only way that a programmed reality could be generated. Basically, the physical reality that we experience could theoretically be generated under program control. Nanotech provides several mechanisms to do that over the probably, I'd say, 60 to 80 year time frame. There's molecular assemblers which can generate almost any kind of matter or any kind of form of matter through a computational mechanism. And then there's a concept of the utility fog, which is a J.-Storrs-Hall concept where you could have billions of nanobots basically that are networked together and are able to reflect light in a certain way or to sort of link physically and provide force against you. So you could theoretically not see them, and then under program control they could turn into a wall or a road to drive on or something like that. And these are some of the more kind of far out concepts of nanotech, but all things that could theoretically be accomplished within our technology within 60 to 80 years. The other sort of evidence that such a concept is possible just comes from video games. And if you go into an electronic superstore and you see some of the games that are running on TVs these days, football, soccer games, seeing simulations and things like that, they look so realistic that you can't tell the difference between those and a real sports event, for example. So we've gotten to the point already where we're fooling our visual senses in terms of alternate realities. We can put on, if we could put on a device, goggles, if you will. Now, I know that some of the virtual reality goggles aren't quite there in terms of resolution yet, but getting close. If you could put those on and experience this from a visual standpoint, you're completely or nearly completely fooled even now into thinking that you're in a different reality. From an audio standpoint, it's very easy to replicate what we experience in reality through headphones and high-quality sound reproductions. And then it's just a matter of the other senses. And this doesn't have to be done in a, you know, kind of a tactile manner. It could, again, be done a la The Matrix with an implant in the brain, for example, that intercepts your sensory inputs and replaces them with something that's under program control. Brain-computer interfaces are, you know, definitely a technology now that is being pursued rapidly.
Yes.
People are able to, blind people are able to see rudimentary grids of light and perceive motion through interface with small cameras. So it's, you know, again, Moore's Law will make all of this stuff possible within 20 or 30 years. So the question has been, if it's possible in 20 or 30 years, if physical manifestation of reality is possible in 60 to 80 years, maybe it's already happening. In fact, there are a lot of logical arguments that it is already happening. One of the most common ones referred to is Nick Bostrom's simulation argument, and people can Google that on the web and find that paper. It's really well written, and it basically provides the logical argument that it's very likely that we're already living in a simulation. Then there's evidence from the fields of quantum mechanics, basically the nature of reality being discrete is very much like a computer program or the way the world is modeled in a, say, a role-playing game or something on a computer. The fine-tuned universe from the fields of cosmology, the way our universe is perfectly finely tuned, is very much, you know, evidence that it's, you know, it's designed in some way. Doesn't necessarily have to be under programmatic control, but it does kind of lend itself to the idea that it's under some sort of design concept. So all these things, evidence from the field of philosophy, from quantum mechanics, from cosmology, and basically I would even put out there that all of these sort of scientific and metaphysical anomalies that exist are things that can be generated easily under program control. I could write a program, any good software developer could write a program that simulates these things, and it's really the only theory that explains all of them at once. So that's kind of in a nutshell a big chunk of the sort of categories of evidence that we're likely to live in a programmed reality.
Yes.
You know, again, as I mentioned before, Henrik, I'm not necessarily a 100% believer, but you know, when I start stacking up the evidence, it sure seems like it's you know, a very likely scenario. And I keep seeing more and more things that happen in our world and happen in the fields of science, discoveries. You know, thermodynamics is another area where people realize that space is filled with energy. Energy is equivalent to information, and space being information is basically just another way of saying that space is under program control.
Really, really interesting. There's so much to that, and I definitely agree with you in regards to that something really weird is going on in that sense. We can even, as you say, we can look at the composition of our own solar system, how the relationship between the moon, the sun, and the earth, how all of this seems, you know, like a mechanism that someone almost, you know, put into place there. How about the idea of a creator or a god in that sense? Is that something they also kind of incorporate into that whole theory or idea?
Sure, and there, you know, you have to be a little careful, I guess, about the use of the word God. You know, I tend to separate it, you know, by saying it's a God with a small g rather than a capital G.
Right, right.
You know, civilization, human civilization has evolved to accept religions that help people be comfortable with, you know, with the idea of a creation or help explain some of these things so people don't feel alone or isolated, and feel that, you know, perhaps there's something to look forward to after death. I mean, have a non, anarchy type of society. So that's, that's one aspect of it. But when you talk about, if our world is created, who is it created by? Would by definition be a god, and you could use that word in that term. So if it's some, programmer in some other, some other galaxy that has created this simulation that we are living in, by definition, I would have to say that they could be our god. But I don't use that in the sort of religious sense of the word.
I understand. Yep, gotcha. Okay, so let's talk about some of the more recent news here in regards to the GEO-600, as it's called. Maybe you can just give us a brief background on what it is, but basically that gravitational wave detector in Germany and some recent events there that seems to suggest or give credence at least to the idea of programmed reality. Tell us more about that, Jim.
Sure. Now, the GEO-600 is a gravitational wave detector in Hanover, Germany, and there are a number of those throughout the world, and what they're trying to do is develop very, very sensitive devices that can detect something that has yet to be detected, which is the idea of a gravitational wave. We know that we have, gravity on our planet because of Newton's law and the fact that things, follow that law and tend to fall. However, and the way that the solar system is constructed and so forth. Mm. However, to have a changing gravitational field generated by perhaps a supernova or a black hole or a rotating black hole or something, some distant perturbation in the universe would help physicists to move along their model of reality and the different forces and how they all interrelate. So one of the schools of physics is to build these gravitational detectors, and they tend to be very long, sort of like a particle accelerator style constructions. Mm-hmm. That use lasers and interferometers to detect very small differences in in an effect that might be influenced by gravity from space, not from our planet. And they have to be really, really sensitive to detect this because the gravitational effects from other galaxies or other events in our galaxies are so small. Mm. And they have to overcome all of the gravitational fluctuations that might occur on our own planet, effects of the moon, effects of other planets, and things like that. So it's a very, very difficult experiment to put together. But probably one of the most sensitive ones in the world is this one in Hanover, Germany. And it's called GEO-600, and I think it's a 600-meter-long laser-based gravitational wave detector. But one of the things that they've been having a lot of trouble with is they've been receiving, as the output of the signal of the detector, noise. Mm-hmm. And, noise happens in a lot of electrical experiments or physical experiments, and you just have to kind of understand where noise comes from. Well, they've pretty much ruled out all of the common sources of noise, and it's a conundrum for these physicists in Germany. They just don't understand where the noise has come from. And the form of the noise has a characteristic that seems kind of like the bit-based graininess of computer-generated models, for example. So, if you were to look at an image, and as you on a computer screen, and as you blow up the image, you start seeing the graininess. You see the pixels of that image, depending on the resolution of it. Mm. And that has certain characteristics. Well, the characteristics of this noise are similar to that, which has prompted one physicist, Craig Hogan, who's the director of Fermilab in Illinois, to speculate, and he actually believes that what has happened is that this gravitational wave detector has reached the limit of space-time resolution, and that what it's seeing is sort of the graininess of space. Now, for your audience who's familiar quantum mechanics and the Planck length, that's really very, very small. So
yes.
The Planck effects get down to, say, 10 to the minus 35th meters, 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. I mean, they're at levels that we can't directly detect by any kind of instrumentation. They're so small. They're known only from a theoretical basis and, you know, ways of inferring them from wavelengths of light and things like that.
Mm.
But this is actually being detected, and it's more in the realm of, say, 10 to the minus 16 meters. So it's 18 or 20 orders of magnitude different from what physicists have previously thought was sort of the limits of the granularity of space.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a curious thing, if this is true, that it is, you know, due to the granularity of space. But what that says is that there's another theory that is was put forth by Leonard Susskind and Gerard de Hooft of Holland, that our reality, our three-dimensional reality, may actually be a projection of processes that are sort of encoded on a two-dimensional surface of, say, the boundary of our universe. And this is kind of an odd concept, but it's very similar to the idea of a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
In a hologram, you create a 3D image on a two-dimensional surface.
Yes.
So you're able to turn that surface on its side, and you can, you know, sort of see around the image. You're very familiar with that, I'm sure.
Yes.
One of the interesting things about a hologram is that if you cut it in half, you still have the entire image in each half of the hologram. It's just that the resolution now and sort of the graininess of that image has increased. The resolution has decreased. The graininess has increased by a factor of two if you cut it in half. And you can keep doing this and cutting the hologram into other pieces, and the smaller it gets, the image is still there, it just gets grainier and grainier. So what these two physicists are saying is that our reality might be a projection, like a hologram, of a two-dimensional reality.
Hmm.
And Dr. Hogan, director of Fermilab, has actually calculated that if this is true, the graininess that we might perceive in our three-dimensional world is actually higher than the Planck length. So it might be on the order of magnitude of what they're seeing at this gravitational wave detector. I hope I explained that well.
Yes.
But
yes.
Basically, the idea is that we could be living in a big hologram, and this noise on this gravitational wave detector is just at the right kind of level and characteristic that might prove this theory.
Because really, if we think about it in the context of a video game, there as well you have resolution, although we have a simulation of a 3D environment, but we have it in the, you know, width and length of the screen resolution that we have, obviously. But much in the same way, reality also actually should have a resolution. And I guess the debate here then is on what the length is, or the you know, how high the resolution is, basically. But what you're saying here is that they've reached the limits already, and they're surprised that it isn't more, how should you call it, more fine than this, right? More detailed than this?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the interesting thing is, and what people don't realize is that physicists really tell us that our space is not a continuous thing. I mean, we think of it as perfectly continuous. You look at the objects in your room, and you know, you can always see something in between two points in time, and or two points in space. And if it gets to the point where your eye is unable to resolve it because your eye has a limit of resolution, there's only so many you know, sensory receptors in your retina.
Yes.
That creates a, you know, limit to the resolution that your eye can have. When you get to that point, you can enhance the ability to see things at finer and finer scales through microscopes and electron microscopes and so forth. But as deep as we probe into the world of the, you know, invisible, or, you know, smaller and smaller scales, everything still looks perfectly smooth and perfectly analog, if you will. But physicists tell us that when you get down to 10 to the minus 35th meters, quantized.
Yes.
So you can't even talk about anything that's in between two points in space. It's either here or it's there. It can't be in between.
Right.
And they also say that time is quantized by the same way, and the relationship between the space and the time quantization is the speed of light. So the time it takes for light to travel from one Planck length to another is the Planck distance, or the Planck time. So we think of time as moving along smoothly, and science has always used sort of a metaphor of a river. You know, time flows like a river, but it's not smooth like that. When you really get down to these scales, time chunks along like a CPU on a computer. It moves along at 10 to the minus 43rd seconds.
Right, right.
And in fact, the logical conclusion of this model is that the universe is basically states of matter locked into this grid of space at the Planck length, clocking along at a frequency that is 1 over the Planck time, and changing the state at each time, you know, in that frequency. So it's the logical conclusion is that our reality works just like a computer. You know, basically it changes states every jiffy, every 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, which is, you know, unbelievably small, but, you know, a good analog to that is just knowing how computer clocking works the same way on a computer program.
Right. But we, I guess the main thing here, though, is that we perceive this as being smooth or linear. We don't see the skips or the jumps in between here, so to speak. And it's all about also our perception of it, because we really have nothing else to compare with, right? If we, let's say that we are in a computer program right now and never been outside it, we don't know much in the same way when they're living in the matrix. They don't have, they're born into the system, so they cannot perceive themselves how it is outside that. Do you follow me?
Absolutely, yeah. No, and that's a really good point. I mean, think of people sitting, you know, who have never experienced a movie before, and they sit in front of a movie screen. Movies traditionally were clocked at only 24 frames per second, but your eyes and your brain kind of assimilate that and fill in the gaps between these time frames. So,
yes.
In other words, for us to perceive very smooth motion really only requires about 60 frames a second. It would look very choppy at 24 frames a second, so old movie projectors would flash the light on each frame two times, so that you would see each frame twice, and so there'd be 48 frames per second, and that was enough to get past that threshold of motion that our perception has. So we perceive motion with a very, very coarse granularity. So imagine how hard it is to perceive the granularity of space or the granularity of time. The only way we can do it is to think about it and to try to develop experiments that can probe that. And our experiments have gotten to the point where, you know, we're probing things that are sort of 10 to the minus 16th meters, you know, the size of the nucleus of the atom.
Yes.
But that's still very, very far from the, you know, the theoretical graininess of reality.
Indeed. Okay, so that's really interesting. So that's just one of these recent examples of what we're discovering. We're coming to the end or the limits of space and space-time, basically. Now, do you think, could it be possible, though, that this is just some kind of, you know, faulty machine part that is, you know, not measuring things correctly? I'm thinking also of course, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. They have, you know, similar problems there that they've started up but have to replace parts, and they're not, I think, starting that up again until sometime during the summer this year, I think.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I kind of feel like they're going to find something. But then you have to ask the question, why did they discover something? You know, there have been a lot of cases in scientific labs where one lab will perform the exact same experiment as another lab and get different results.
Yep.
And there has been quite a bit of research on this effect that lends to the idea that as clean as the experiment might be, the results of the experiment have something to do with the mentality of the experimenters.
Absolutely.
Whether they believe they're going to find something or don't believe they're going to find something seems to impact what they find.
Yes.
And
that could be said in the context of all the experiments we do. I'm thinking of experiments that is involving in cold fusion. We have allegedly two guys that were managed to pull it off many years ago, but since then many of the skeptical parts of the scientific community haven't been able to pull it off. That's just one example. We don't have to dwell on that, but I see what you mean, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably the best and most recent example. I think there have been, I read at one point, over 80 confirmations of Fleischmann and Pons' cold fusion experiment.
Yes.
And yet there are some that don't confirm it. Another was back in 1980, Wolfgang Pauli had predicted the neutrino a long time ago, and it was discovered. Then there was another sort of anomaly relating to neutrinos about whether or not they had mass. So it was predicted that they had mass. In 1980, the Soviet Union did some experiments that indicated that a neutrino did actually have mass, but other physicists around the world couldn't reproduce those experiments, so they were to some extent discounted. But it does then go to the idea of intent and how this is all another idea tied up in quantum mechanics, that the observer effect, observing things, actually impacts those things.
Yes.
So there's another experiment that's been done not too long ago I found very interesting in Vienna. You're probably familiar with that one as well. Just last year, a team of physicists basically proved that reality doesn't exist until you observe it.
Yes.
And this came from a long history of the debate of some of the paradoxes of quantum mechanics. So there are a couple things that were very odd about quantum mechanical theory. One is that particles get entangled. So if two particles sort of interact with each other at one point in time, then forever it seems their behavior is in sync. So you could take, say, two particles that were part of a physical experiment that that interacted with each other, separate those particles by theoretically light years, and when one of them flips or changes its spin or whatever, then the other one does as well. And it's almost like they're in lockstep, and they violate, theoretically, if one believes that the reason that one particle is changing due to another particle is because they're communicating with each other, or there's some force field between them, then that force field would have to be faster than the speed of light, which relativity forbids. So this is one of the other kind of conundrums of quantum mechanics, is called locality, that there seems to be a violation of locality. In addition to that, there seems to be a violation of reality, in that certain experiments, the results of the experiments depend on whether or not they're being observed. So there's been a long history of sort of a theoretical treatment of this. David Bohm and John Bell and others have basically proven that if quantum mechanics is correct, then one of two things has to be wrong. Either reality doesn't exist the way we think it does, or locality doesn't exist the way we think it does.
Right.
And again, just recently, over the last couple of years, this team of physicists in Vienna solved that argument and proved that reality doesn't exist the way we think it does. In other words, it doesn't exist until it's observed, which is just really kind of a mind-blowing concept, but it has a very convenient answer in programmed reality. In programmed reality, it's very easy to imagine a scenario where you have to actually observe things for them to exist.
Yes.
And we can delve into that a lot deeper if you'd like to. I'm not sure if you wanted to go into that now or move on in a different direction.
We can, I guess we can hold off on that, because there's a lot of questions around that we can speculate more on later on. But I do want to get into the next topic, if you will, of what we're going to discuss here today about basically this idea that the singularity will not occur. I think that we'll be good to dive into that right away. And I know that you wrote a little bit about this, that, you know, Ray Kurzweil, of course, one of the proponents of the singularity, the technological singularity, that this will happen. And then there's J. Ron Lanier, another guy who's talking. And as I understand it, these two guys have a little bit of not maybe dispute, but they're a little bit different in how they think that this will come about. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. The singularity, just for kind of set the stage for it, is this idea that trends in technology, you know, due to Moore's law, are increasing at this exponential pace. And if you ever see an exponential plot on a graph, it moves along kind of slowly, and then suddenly it turns vertical. It's like, you know, you used to see predictions of the population explosion, that the planet was going to get overpopulated so quickly that if you plot the population of the Earth over time, people were predicting that it was just going to go into this sort of vertical direction, and, you know, we would have this kind of crazy, very, very fast population. And in fact, it happens in cases where you bring non-indigenous plants or animals into a region. I know back in the 1800s, rabbits were introduced to Australia, and if you plot the population of rabbits, they started off, you know, a couple rabbits, four rabbits, eight rabbits, whatever, and then very quickly, sort of asymptotically approached this, you know, very, very fast population growth, but it stopped. And of course it stopped. It has to stop at some point, because you can't just, you know, kind of overrun a continent with animals. Those animals need something to feed on as well.
Yes.
So there's going to be a leveling off effect due to a million other reasons, sunlight, food sources, predators, whatever. You can't have that asymptotic effect. So although a lot of people have predicted these exponential rises and things, oftentimes they eventually level out. And, you know, what I'm saying is that I think that's going to happen with the singularity as well. The prediction that Kurzweil has is that our technology is doubling so quickly. Moore's law says that you double the transistor density every couple of years, and you double the speed of processors every couple of years, maybe 3 years. And because of that, artificial intelligence will occur very quickly. And once artificial intelligence occurs, then that will assimilate all knowledge on the internet and all knowledge. And then AI will create, you know, other AIs that are smarter than it. And we'll just sort of be left in the dust unless we merge with AI in a way, which we are doing. I mean, we're having computer enhanced devices in our bodies all the time. They're talking about computer-enhanced vision and computer-enhanced memory and things like this. So this whole sort of brave new world idea of technology just going crazy asymptotically is what's called the singularity. Mm-hmm. And Kurzweil predicts that to occur in the year roughly 2045. And there are quite a few other people who support his notion. And his arguments are very good. You know, the book is very well written. His book I'm referring to is called The Singularity is Near.
Yeah.
It's well written, well thought out. He's a very intelligent guy. But as we've seen, there are intelligent people who disagree with other intelligent people, and they have completely different points of view.
Indeed.
So it doesn't take much to kind of Google singularity, and you'll find all the pros and cons, and you'll find all sorts of physicists and thinkers and futurists who say, hey, it's never going to occur, and then others who say, of course it's going to occur, and they all have very good arguments. So, you know, that's just a little bit about the singularity. In my view is that it will not occur for a number of reasons. One is the fact that we'll get information overload. Another has to do with software. Another has to do with just, you know, if programmed reality is what we think it is, programmed reality needs to prevent it from occurring just the way it may have prevented a nuclear catastrophe from occurring or the population explosion from occurring.
Now, tell us about that. Do you mean that the program itself is, it cannot allow it to be, I guess, destroyed then or overrun by something else or discovered? Or explain that a little bit for us.
Sure, sure. Well, imagine, let's just use an analogy. Let's say that you've created a program like, oh, say, World of Warcraft or EverQuest. These are programs that games, role-playing games that millions of people play online, and they're extremely popular. They're big revenue generators for Sony and their respective companies. So the programmers create these games, and they put them out there, and they watch and see what the players do. Mm-hmm. And they find out that sometimes there are some flaws in the game. Maybe, for example, the rules that are put into the game allow people to kill each other easily or find a way to kill each other or steal from each other. And then it becomes no fun for the newbies in the game, and they don't want to play anymore, and the game sort of dies a natural death.
Right.
Well, those programmers have to fix that. If they're going to want to maintain this game for whatever reason, in their case, it's for revenue generation purposes, they have to fix that. They have to put in new rules. They have to put in patches to the game to prevent fragging or people from killing each other or stealing each other's property and things like that. Or they make it difficult so that only a few people can do it, and those rogue elements are there in the game to make life, to make the game a little bit more interesting, but they don't overrun the game, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes, so, indeed.
So from that analogy, if you could imagine that if we are living in a programmed reality and the programmers who have created our reality are significantly more advanced than we are, they would have to be to create a universe simulation that we're living in, then they're probably advanced enough to put the rules in to prevent things from happening that would basically destroy the game. So take the Singularity, for example. The Singularity would be sort of a civilization-ending event. Maybe it doesn't end civilization, but it ends humanity as we know it.
Yes.
The only way to survive the Singularity would be to merge with machines. So
if not that is part of the program or whatever.
I'm sorry.
If that might not be the part of the program, or whatever, right? It could be some kind of, because really, if we talk about it in these terms, we're really talking about it in the terms of experiments, and the programmers are really kind of free to do really what they want to do with us, right?
Right, exactly. And so what could happen if the singularity occurs is that basically the game would have to end. So if the intent of the programmers is to keep this game going or this reality going for some reason, then they can't let that happen. They can't let it end. So if you believe in this model, which I tend to do, then you have to believe that there can't be a civilization-ending event. It's always going to reverse. And if you look in history, you find that really has been the case. Back in the 60s, we were 2 seconds to doomsday. Somebody had created the doomsday clock, and it just seemed like it was inevitable. That the Soviet Union and the United States had their fingers on the button that would just send missiles to each other, and like the least. The least little thing would cause that to happen.
Yes.
The least, the smallest, crisis or event might cause that to happen. And it just seemed like we were, right at the threshold of destroying the world. So did it seem that way during the Industrial Revolution, according to some people. And it seemed that way in the 70s with the specter of population explosion. Now it seems that way, over this century, by global warming.
Yes.
People are talking about the end of civilization because of global warming. And then again, I read other things that may be reversing a little bit as well.
Of course.
So
yeah.
I guess my argument is that the reversal of these civilization-ending trends is going to be inevitable if there is a programmed reality. It has to happen. Otherwise, the game or the reality has to end. So it doesn't prove that we're in a programmed reality, but it lends a little bit of support to it. It kind of explains why things tend to be the way they do.
That's very interesting. That's really, really interesting. So in a way, things are balancing out themselves in order to keep the program running. I mean, one tends to wonder, though, even I guess the game must progress as well. I'm thinking about in the terms of technology. I mean, we're still in a situation then where we're kind of allowed to develop things. We're allowed to develop technology and make it go faster and explore in that area, of course. But what would you think? Well, I guess we can go into that idea then of how this is flattening out itself, because what you're saying is that there won't be a divine intervention here, so to speak, where someone comes in and change dramatically, you know, patch the program or whatever, but things will automatically balance themselves out, right? So if we talk about this in terms of technology or the singularity, we're seeing this exponential growth all the time. But so this is something that you will see will slowly die out, is that correct, or flattening the trend?
Yep, I see it flattening. I see it flattening now. So for an example, one of Ray Kurzweil's charts that's often used shows how long between different sort of paradigm-shifting events occur. So evolutionary events, when did humans first walk upright, when was Homo sapiens evolved, when did we develop art, when did we develop symbolic thinking, writing, the wheel, printing, industrial revolution, all these, you know, are sort of on a timeline, and he shows this very exponential timeline that kind of implies that we are heading toward a singularity, if you follow the timeline. However, the very recent paradigm-shifting event was considered to be the World Wide Web, and the previous one to that was the creation of the personal computer. Mm. The time between those two was 13 years. So if we were really on this exponential track, the next major paradigm-shifting event should have occurred around 2000-2001. But there wasn't one. I mean, the kinds of things that we're talking about are a computer passing the Turing test, true artificial intelligence, or true creation of artificial life, or maybe, say, perfection of brain-computer interfaces or something like that. Mm. And those things are still a few years off. So, you know, again, it's a small number of data points, but if you believe the singularity people, they would, you know, we should have had that event already. But in reality, our next paradigm-shifting event is probably going to be maybe 17 years after the World Wide Web, mm-hmm. as opposed to the 13 years between PC and World Wide Web. So just by looking at that, things seem to be slowing down a little bit. Another big category of evidence for the slowing down of technology occurs, I mean, even clock rates in processors have been stuck at 3 gigahertz for a little bit, a little while.
That's true.
So there's a, you know, just one other data point of evidence. But another thing I found interesting was I did a little research on, you know, I was very curious to see how the performance of PCs has really increased over the years when you take into account the operating system and the software that you're running. So I looked at things like how long does it take for a PC to boot up? Mm. How long does it take to render a 3D model? How long does it take to run a spreadsheet or something like that? And it turns out those aren't moving exponentially. In fact, in some of those cases, PCs are slower than they used to be. Let me see. Just looking for the results here. Okay. The benchmark comparison on the performance of 6 different Word versions over the years, mm-hmm. Microsoft Word, and they summed up 5 typical operations. The fastest was Word 95 in 1995 at 3 seconds.
Oh,
Word 2007
great.
Was 12 seconds long.
Uh-huh.
There was another article in PC World that compared the boot up time of a 1981 PC to that of a 2001 PC 20 years later, and the 2001 was 3 times slower than the one in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And people will say, well, of course, you know, MS-DOS was, it was a small footprint, it didn't do that much.
Right.
But in terms of real productivity, does Vista really offer you that much more as an operating system than DOS did back then?
Mm.
Yeah, it offers some more, but does it offer exponentially more? Am I able to create a spreadsheet that much faster than I could back in 1981? The answer is no. So that exponential trend in terms of real use of computer power has flattened out.
That's the basically what you're describing there is the software and the clogging up of the software. And I think that either it was a Ray Kurzweil or it might have been someone else who talked about this idea that here is where AI comes in, because the one who described this, we're talking about the fact that he recognized that our faulty area right now is the software, basically to run things faster, more efficient, to write software that is basically much better and run much better on the machines that we have. But that's a tricky area, though, because on one level, I guess we have to develop an AI first in order to even come to that point where an AI can begin to, you know, regenerate itself or create generations of itself that is better and so forth. But do you think that will that create a leap forward if we come to the point where we even create AI, or do you think even that is something that never will happen?
I think that we'll create AI. I mean, there was actually a recent competition where the computer, the program fooled, I think, 70% of the, I don't remember exactly what the percentage was, but fairly large percent of the of the auditors, which was almost enough to say that it passed the Turing test. So, you know, we're getting pretty close to the point where we can create an AI that is able to at least converse with people and fool you into thinking you're human. But it's not the same as saying that it can do everything that the human brain can do. I think that it's possible. I'm not sure. I don't think it's going to happen as soon as Kurzweil says that it will. Mm-hmm. But if it does happen, you know, I would agree that it's probably going to speed up inventions quite a bit, which has the possibility of leaving humans in the dust, leaving us sort of as sort of second class citizens.
Yes.
But the other thing that I'm a little concerned about is what is referred to commonly as infomania.
Yes.
And that's this idea that we can only assimilate so much growth in technology or so much change. And we see that in the workplace. Intel did a study back in 1999 that showed that people were spending, I think, 2.9 hours per day processing emails. And in 2006, they did a study showing that people were spending about 4 hours a day processing email. So the growth of email interrupts has definitely increased over the years. If you project that forward, you get to the point in about 2013, as I showed in the paper, where you actually don't have enough time to do real work. You spend all your time just interrupt processing.
Right.
That's very inefficient. It's inefficient because not just because of the total number of interrupts you have, but it causes a context shift in your head. You might be thinking about something, get interrupted, and get back into the zone where you were, you know, making progress on that thing you were thinking about takes time. So, you know, we may have productivity tools that help reduce this effect, but we are no doubt reaching the limit of our brain's ability to assimilate change at a rapid pace. And so that's another limitation that I think we're running into, which helps kind of flatten out this exponential effect.
I definitely recognize that. I mean, and really, I'm thinking of a lecture I saw with a guy called Gerd Lennard or something like that, a German guy, a German name. He's a kind of a media futurist. He was talking at Google in London, I think, a little bit about basically the future of the web. He was talking about in the context of how you market with this, with the new environment of the web and so forth. But he mentioned a little bit about this as well, actually, about the development of web 1.0 up to 2.0 and even up to 3.0 and further on, of course. But this basic idea, the web 1.0 was basically about accumulation of information, getting as much as you can. Then Web 2.0 was about creating the content yourself in that sense. All these sites were popping up, like YouTube, where basically YouTube isn't doing anything. They're just providing the infrastructure for everyone else to put information in there, so to speak, that everyone can get. And then he was talking about Web 3.0, that was more about the filtering of information, that there's so much out there now, so the only way to get to some kind of place where you end up getting the information that you really want. Because as you say, Jim, otherwise we'll just be sitting there and sifting through information that is totally irrelevant, but we don't maybe ahead of time know that it's irrelevant or relevant because we must look through it in order for that to take place. But we must have some kind of intelligent system. And I guess that it's here also where a type of AI comes in, that we need something that filters the information for us beforehand. For instance, an email. Is the email relevant? Can someone else, you know, can I put in certain parameters for this to automatically go to the junk folder or something like that? You know what I mean? And I think he at least were talking about this idea that that's the next step in order for us to progress forward or propel forward. What do you think about an idea like that, Jim?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. I think things like spam filters are an example of that. It have to have some intelligence in there to determine if something's going to be useful to you or not. And there's a lot of work being done to research those kinds of productivity tools. Spam filters, essentially, the productivity tool. It helps you filter out email that you don't that you don't need. So these are the kinds of things that are working against the tendency to be interrupt-driven, and they have to happen. You're absolutely right. They have to happen for us to work better, to work more effectively, to work faster. But the interesting thing is that now you've generated an entire industry of filtering tools and productivity enhancement tools that have to occur for us to make any kind of progress at all in terms of our efficiency and how we develop things.
Yes.
And that's because we, technology has caused us to kind of reach our limits of attention span and ability to process things. So, yep, absolutely. Go ahead.
I guess also that this is where this idea comes in of their strive for something like, for instance, brain-computer interfaces or something where we, for instance, must have ability to process information faster than. I mean, as you say, that the limits are kind of reached already in a way to make, efficient work day or what have you, but we need to even make things faster and faster and faster and faster. And that creates, of course, something other that you wrote about in your paper, which is just that, related to stress, which is related to the fact that we're so undermined with all this information, the flow of information that we end up doing nothing all day, and that creates stress, and we need to, as you wrote in your paper, we're sitting there with over lunch, for instance, and writing email or responding to someone, or we don't even allow ourselves to have the time to have a little space for ourselves anymore. We're available. We're online 24/7, 365 days around the year, right?
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've noticed the same thing. I certainly have, and a lot of people that I talk to, I am in that industry, and I remember the days when a lunch period in the middle of the day was sort of a sacrosanct period. People, it was just assumed that you could take an hour off or even half an hour off and, take some time to ramp down from work and have a sandwich and not talk about work and so forth. And at the end of the day, you go home and you spend time with your family and you don't, talk about work and you're not interruptible at the end of the day or on weekends. It's really different now. I go to meetings where there's a dozen people in the meetings and they're all sitting there on their laptops processing other things while other people are talking. So they're not paying attention.
Yeah.
If you have 12 people in a room doing email on their laptop while somebody else is trying to carry on a conversation, then that's not productive work and that's not productive behavior.
Yeah. But
that's the way things are. I watch people check their BlackBerries and their iPhones while they're eating lunch, just to make sure they don't miss an email. And there's an effect of feeling important that goes along with it. And there's also an effect of sort of an expectation that people respond quickly to interrupts. It used to be that if somebody sent you an email or left a phone call, it was reasonable to assume unless there's an offsetting set of productivity tools or enhancements, as we talked about before, you know, that trend is going to, you know, to flatten out our ability to create AIs, to create, you know, the next generation of tools that, that allow us to progress faster. So this is what I mean by sort of a flattening effect. It's not that, hey, we're never going to get there. It's that there, maybe there used to be no impediments to the trend of Moore's Law to develop artificial intelligence, but now there's tremendous impediments.
Yes.
Impediments of productivity impediments, and just basically, you know, stress management impediments.
Very interesting. I'd love to continue talking a little bit more about that, the idea of you know, that the quality of work is something that will potentially, or that's something that's diminishing. I also want to get into a little bit more here in our next segment about the idea of quantum computers or biological computers as something else, another type of technology might come on the scene that actually totally revolutionizes things like this. And then maybe more, if you have the time for us, Jim, go into a little bit more about this idea of reality as something that has to do with how the way the brain even decodes reality, and if that's a part of the program or if just that's a part of a kind of the holographic universe theory. So I'd love to continue talking more with you here in the next segment, Jim. But before we round things off here for the first segment, go ahead and mention your website, because there's a lot of this kind of information up there for people who are interested in this. And of course, you have your book up there as well, The Universe Solved. Kind of talks more about the evidence for programmed reality. And is the best way to get a copy of the book simply go to your website, Jim? Is that correct?
Yeah, sure. If you go to the website, you can order the book directly, and I'll sign the copies that are purchased from the website because I have those in stock. It's a hardcover book, and I'll sign those and send those out. But however, that pertains pretty much just to listeners from the United States. If you're in Europe or elsewhere, the best thing to do is go through Amazon. Now, I know it, the book's available on Amazon UK, and I know people in Australia have purchased the book and some people in continental Europe. However, I think it's probably a little bit more expensive than getting it from the U.S. Amazon site. But anyway, basically, it's available on Amazon. It's available on BarnesandNoble.com. It's available in some bookstores, and it is available on the site, depending on where you are.
Okay, very good. So the main website to check out there is theuniversesolved.com, and I will have these and other links up on redicecreations.com as well, so you can easily find links to the book and so forth. Okay, well, for this segment, thank you very much, Jim. Let's continue talking in the next segment. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you, Henrik.
Thank you for tuning in. Don't miss our part two with Jim Elwidge. We're going to discuss quantum computers and biological computers, the soul, the brain, teleportation, pre-programmed reality, and the power of 10. Head on over to redicecreations.com and find out how to tune in. If you're only joining us for part one, we will be back on Thursday with Lynn Marsouli, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Alien Interviews, on UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, alien implants, abduction, and more. A long time since we did a program on those topics, so that's going to be really interesting. Let's listen to some Bob Marley now, and then we'll continue with the part two.